In every way, Jesus is central in salvation, both in His foundation and completion. It is true that Jesus is the only way for you personally to participate in salvation by obtaining it and maturing in it by growing up into Christ in all things. It is in this sense that He is the way, the truth, and the life. For as Jesus said, "No man cometh to the Father but by Me," John 14:6. It is not that you come to the Father with Jesus by your side as a sort of key that unlocks the door, and that is not what He meant. Rather, it is that He brings you to God. Of course, the Scriptures categorically say this, so it ought not to sound strange to anyone. In 1 Peter 3:18, Peter wrote, "For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that He might bring us to God." This same facet of Jesus' role in your salvation is accented in Hebrews 7:25. "Wherefore He's able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by Him, seeing He ever liveth to make intercession for them." That is, He is personally conducting us to the Father and interceding for us at the same time. That, listener, is how difficult it is for anyone to be saved. They have to be brought to God by Jesus, and He must also intercede for them all along the way to the Father. There is an appointed time when we will all stand before the Lord. At that time, it will be perfectly clear how essential it was for Jesus to personally bring us there and for Him constantly to intercede for us, ensuring that we received the proper resources and that God was pleased to receive us. Of course, Jesus made these things plain when He said He came to seek and save that which was lost, Luke 19:10. That is, He had to find them, pick them up, and carry them to God, just as the good shepherd who found the lost sheep laid it on his shoulder and came home with the sheep to the fold where it belonged, Luke 15:5 and 6. That is something of what is involved in Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life, and us coming to the Father by Him, that is, by means of Him. There is something very wonderful that makes it right for Jesus to do this, and that is the thing I want to declare in this message. Jesus Christ is the substitute, the one who stood in our place when God dealt with sin, for sin had to be dealt with. It could not be ignored. The penalty for sin had to be paid by someone, and it is sure the price could not be paid by us, for we could not have survived it. That price involved the judgment of God against sin. It involved taking the entire mass of sin, the sins of the whole world, and placing it upon a person. That is, that He had to localize sin, then pour out His wrath upon it. It involved God cursing sin in a person. Obviously, this could not be done to any of Adam's offspring, for they had sins of their own. No man who came from Adam was adequate to be a substitute for the rest of the race. Therefore, Jesus enters into the picture. There are two sides to Jesus' atoning death. While it is true that He died because God so loved the world, He also died because God hated sin so much. That is a fact no man can afford to ignore. The divine nature cannot stand sin, to look at it, much less patiently endure it. God's character demanded that sin be punished, cursed, and put out of the way once for all. This could not be done by simply speaking it away. God declares Himself to be incapable of simply ignoring sin and treating the individual as though it was not there. The ones who had sinned had to be punished. His righteousness demanded it. For anyone but the living God, this was an impossible situation. No angel, no matter how lofty, could have conceived of a way for man to be cursed and yet be saved also. However, God had confirmed in His law that there was a way in which an innocent victim could be held responsible for the sins of the people. It was prefigured or introduced in the sacrifices made under the law. The sins of the people were symbolically transferred to an animal by the priest laying his hands upon a sacrificial animal. Then that animal was killed, suffering the death that was really due the ones committing the sin. The blood of the animal was then offered to God, confirming that the whole procedure was a sort of picture of pleasing God or meeting His requirement. The routine is outlined in Exodus 29:10 through 14. The animal is referred to as a sin offering. It is an example of a substitute. Theologically, this is called a vicarious death. That is, a death that took place in the behalf of someone else. A death that wrought benefits that could be experienced by the offending parties. Now let us get to the matter of Jesus being the one and only substitute. The one who was made responsible for the sins of humanity, bore the judgment of God against sin, and satisfied the requirements of God's nature. The first clear depiction of a substitute was established when Abraham was commanded by God to offer up Isaac as a burnt offering to God. The account is found in the 22nd chapter of Genesis. To make a long story short, just as Abraham was about to plunge the knife into Isaac, the angel of the Lord stopped him, saying that it was now apparent that he feared God, being willing not to withhold his only son from the Lord. It was then that Abraham looked behind him and saw a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. The text states in verse 13, "And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him for a burnt offering in the stead of his son." Verse 13, that ram was the substitute for Isaac. In precisely the same manner, Jesus was our substitute. Isaiah was chosen by God to prophesy of this essential aspect of the Messiah, and he did so well. His words on the substitutionary aspect of his death are found in the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. Verses 4 through 6 particularly declare the truth of Christ's substitution. "Surely he hath borne our griefs, carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all." Now there are two sides to this that must be seen. First, our guilt and its effects had to be removed from us. Second, the benefits we required had to be given to us. As to our guilt and its effects, they are declared to be our transgressions and our iniquities. These are infractions of both the law and nature of God. When men did what God said not to do, and did not do what he said to do, and thought and lived differently than God himself who made them. The effects of these transgressions and iniquities are referred to as our griefs and our sorrows. Some versions read infirmities and diseases. These, however, are not a reference to things we are experiencing, that is, they are not describing the misery that had come on the human race because of their sins. The root meaning of the word grief is calamity, not infirmity, as ordinarily conceived. The root meaning of sorrows is anguish or pain, not diseases, as ordinarily conceived. I know this contradicts what some have said about this matter, but that really is of no consequence to me. I want to know, and I want you to know, what God is saying in this passage, not what men wish he was saying. The truth of the matter is that he is speaking of the grief and sorrow that had to come from God upon those who had sinned against him. We're not left to conjecture about this. It is categorically stated in the 10th verse of this chapter. "Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand." Isaiah 53:10. This did not involve making Jesus sick or filling him with diseases, because it was his soul, the text affirms, that was made an offering for sin. In other words, in being put to grief, Jesus was experiencing the grief and sorrow that was due to us. That is, when he cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" This is when, as Paul put it in Galatians 3:13, he was made a curse for us. It is when, as 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, he was made to be sin for us. Or as Hebrews 2:9 states it, that he might taste death for every man. The psalmist spoke of Christ's experience on the cross in the 22nd Psalm, which details his experience on that cross. There in verse 6, Jesus is depicted as saying, "I am a worm and no man." That is, when he bore the griefs and sorrows that were due us, the curse of God, the abandonment of God, and the judgment of God was upon him. Isaiah goes on to say that Jesus was stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. The people around the cross concluded this is what was happening, but they concluded it for the wrong reasons. Jesus was stricken, smitten, and afflicted of God, but not because he had done wrong, as his oppressors thought. He did this as our substitute. Or as Isaiah says in verse 5, he was bruised for our iniquities, not his own. He was indeed being chastened by God, yet it was not for anything he himself had done. Rather, it was a chastisement that belonged to our peace. That is, for us to have peace, chastening was required, and Jesus bore the chastening. Because we could not hold up under the chastening of the Almighty, Jesus stepped into our place and took a chastening so grievous that recovery required that he rise from the dead. We needed to be healed because we were, as Peter put it in 1 Peter 2:25, as sheep going astray. Now, however, that we were healed by the stripes laid upon Jesus by God himself, We have returned to the shepherd and bishop of our souls. It was the substitute that enabled this recovery and return. Isaiah also makes a point of this in the 6th verse of the 53rd chapter of his prophecy. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. In his exposition of the death of Christ in 1 Peter 1:24 through 25, Peter makes clear that the substitute was dealing with our sins, not physical illness. The problem with humanity was not its illnesses, but its sin. Therefore, Peter affirms that Jesus bare our sins in his body on the tree. This is his exposition of Isaiah 53:4 through 6. He died that we might become dead to sins and live under righteousness. It is from that condition that we were healed by his stripes. That is, he stood where we stood so we could stand where he stands. He was the substitute. He endured the status of rejection in order that we might enjoy the status of acceptance. He was the substitute. He was cut off that we might be grafted in. He was cursed in order that we might be blessed. He was the substitute. He took what we had in order that we might receive what he had, righteousness. He was the substitute. Now this consistently is declared in apostolic doctrine, that Jesus was the substitute. It is written in Romans 5:8, God commendeth his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. He was our substitute. Again it is written in Romans 8:32, he spared not his own son but delivered him up for us all. He was our substitute, enabling God to give us freely all things. Hear the word of 1 Corinthians 5:7. Purge therefore out the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, as ye are unleavened. For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. He was our substitute, enabling us to become pure and holy. Again in Ephesians 5:2 it is written, and walk in love, as Christ also hath loved us, and hath given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. He is our substitute. Paul affirms in 1 Thessalonians that this substitution was in order that we might live with Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. He is our substitute, guaranteeing that those who live by faith will live together with Jesus. In Titus 2:14, Paul said of Jesus, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from all iniquity and purify unto himself a peculiar people zealous of good works. He was our substitute, guaranteeing that those who trust in him will be freed from the power of iniquity and be a special people to God, noted for being eager to do good works. As the substitute, Jesus not only dealt effectively with our past, but he also secured our future. He not only took away our sins, but he cleared the way for us to become righteous and for that glorious work to be done in all righteousness. As a substitute, he endured the curse of God that we might enjoy the blessing of God, being made the righteousness of God in him. Now, listener, how reasonable is it for a person to live for themselves when Jesus died for them? How can anyone justify being selfish when Jesus was selfless? What possible reason can be presented for choosing to sin when the substitute was required to remove it from the presence of the Lord? See, there is no justification for sin. There is only justification from sin. That justification accomplished by the substitute removed every reason for sinning. It clearly established that God cannot stand sin and will not tolerate it, even when it's laid upon his spotless son. All of this means the secret to overcoming sin is not knowing the rules of the game, but perceiving the reality of the substitute. Now listener, as Jesus would say, go thy way and sin no more.